What is up, everybody? Welcome back to the show, Vintage and Stuff, with your host, Drew Heifetz. Today, I have Jordan Peck, a.k.a. Idaho Jeans 2. His first account, Idaho Jeans, got hacked, so he's now Idaho Jeans 2. He's only been in the game a short time of 5 years, but this gentleman has seen more denim, touched more denim, dug out more crazy denim, bucklebacks, Big E's, Levi's, salvaged Lees and Wranglers and all that stuff than most people who've been doing it for much longer, including myself, who's been doing it for 20 years. So, wealth of knowledge in this area. He's in a great location to be doing that. He digs out farms, barns, estates, ranches, what have you. He grew up on a ranch himself, so he knows the game, okay? He also grew up going into mine shafts. Okay, this kid was, well, he's not a kid now, but when he was a kid, he was lowering himself into mine shafts. Who does that? As a parent now myself, he's also a family man. I'll be tripping if my kids were doing that. But really, really great episode, okay, guys? I want to run a quick little contest here. If you're watching this on YouTube, I am going to be giving away credit to fasinfrankvintage.com here on this episode. $100 credit to fasinfrankvintage.com. That includes free shipping. All you got to do is go comment down below where you listen to Vintage and Stuff podcast. Wrong answers only. I'll pick my favorite answer. That person gets $100 credit to fasinfrankvintage.com, my company. Also, if you want to just go shop it, go do that. There's a link down below. But I'm giving away $100 credit for the best, stupidest, wildest comment down below. As a little appreciation, guys. Appreciation for you guys tuning in. I want to give back to you guys who give me so much. All right. So there's been some changes, okay? Right now, you're probably tuned in to the free 45-minute version of the show today with Jordan, a.k.a. Idaho Jeans 2. If you guys want to tune into the full episode, you can jump on the Patreon. This episode is over 2 hours long, probably going to be like 2.5 hour long episode of all things denim, all things digging, all things bucklebacks, salvage, Big E. Full version of the show, you got to jump on the Patreon. You can also sub for a membership on my channel if you're watching on YouTube, and the full version will be there. This is the 45-minute free version for you guys. We're switching it up. I get hit up by people all the time that are like, I learned so much from your show. I've learned so much. It taught me all these things. You know, I got into the business because of your show. And I appreciate you guys. I appreciate all those comments. I appreciate, you know, what this show potentially has done for all you guys out there. So saying that, you know, now if you want the full versions where you're going to learn all kinds of crazy stuff, it's going to be small fee, jump on the Patreon, or sub for a membership here. It ends up being about $1 or $2, depending on how much I post every month per episode. It's a very small price to pay, but it means so much to me, people who work with me, the time I spend into this, your money goes towards hosting, goes towards all the different fees involved with producing the show, and gets me fired up to make more episode and keep going here, okay? So some of you might be shocked here, but that's how it's going now. Free 45-minute episode. If you want the full 2 hours with Jordan, you got to sign up to Patreon or sub to the YouTube channel. Some things that you'll see, you'll get on the 2 hour version versus the 45-minute version is tips and tricks on digging. Lots of show and tell about Big E and Buckleback denim. Lots of show and talks about how to source and just crazy stories. And like, we will fit as much as we can into this 45-minute episode, but there's a lot more good juice. There's a lot more juice to squeeze out of this episode. So sign up below. That's it. Don't want to waste too much time here on the intro. Make sure you like this. Make sure you tap the little like button there. I appreciate it. Put the notifications on so when the new episodes pop up, make sure you sub to the Patreon. Make sure you comment down below to win $100 store credit to fasinfrankvintage.com. Let's go.
Jordan, welcome to the show.
How's it going,
Thank
buddy?
Thank you for coming on. It's going good.
Right on.
Going real good. So, you know, it's I don't actually know you very well. We've chatted a few times at events and things, and what I do know about you is that you have a lot of crazy denim. That is for sure.
I don't get out much. Usually in a barn or in the mountains somewhere. So usually pretty private like that, but.
Good places to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I did see you at Durango at Brit's event.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was crazy.
It was quite a unique event for sure. And you had a table. I mean, I didn't know it was your table at first. I'm like just walking around. We're under the tent. It's a small, intimate show. And you just had this crazy table full of bucklebacks. Which you don't really see very often. You never see that much crazy stuff in one place. So that's the impression I have of you is that you have a lot of bucklebacks.
Yeah, it's my thing. I mean, I do a lot of digging kind of in those really crazy barns and stuff and find a lot of the lows and mids. But anytime I find a buckleback, I have a hard time letting it go. Seems a lot of people find them and it's easy money. I mean, everybody wants a pair. They'll pay a couple grand and then they flip them. I have a hard time letting them go. So when I get one, I usually try and hang on to it.
So how many do you have in your possession then right now?
A lot.
Crazy. Okay. I did not know that.
150 maybe something.
Wow.
A lot.
How many of those would be Levi's?
Can't tell you that. A couple dozen probably.
That's wild. I had no idea. So it makes sense that you had a full table of them.
Mm-hmm.
So let's kick this off with jumping back to the beginning. Like, how did you get into this? We know your handle is Idaho Jeans, Jeans too, because you said you got hacked.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in Idaho. We know that.
Yeah. Right?
But how did you get started into selling vintage denim?
So I was born at a very young age. No, sorry. Terrible joke. I originally went to school for petroleum and petrophysics engineering and got out, started making crazy money and just was working for the man and hated it. Absolutely hated it. I've been a picker, digger.
Petroleum engineering.
Yeah.
Is that what you said?
Yeah. Petroleum and petrophysics. So wellbore stuff, reservoir characterization and just an oily, I guess they call us.
Wow, that's crazy. So one of your friends did say that you're very good with the numbers. Science and the numbers.
Nerdy, yeah.
Okay.
I kind of hated it. I mean, the money was crazy, but I got tired of working for the man, if you know what I'm saying. And I've always been a 100%. Picker, been doing it since I was, 7 years old, 6 years old. I started flipping deer antlers and then started getting into other antiques and I think it was 5 years ago, I was helping my brother remodel this old house in a mystery town. There's a lot of mystery towns. Mystery town, Idaho.
And, mystery town, USA.
Mystery town, USA. And we were trying to put this chimney up through the ceiling and then through the roof. And it was a pain in the butt because it was this deep in denim. Just jeans.
No shit.
Jeans and sweatshirts and t-shirts and all this stuff. And it was like, I was like, I don't know what to do with this crap. It's in the way. We're like scooping it out of the way. And I got a wild hair that it could be worth something and reached out to a guy who I won't name. And he rolled up in the middle of the night in a blizzard and swept it all away. And come to find out later, it was worth a little more than I thought it was. But there was a pretty good stack of bucklebacks and
so it was like the attic was stuffed with clothes.
Yeah.
And trying to run a chimney up through it.
Mm-hmm. And so they used it to insulate this old building. There was that much up there. And there was dozens and dozens of pairs of blue jeans. And there was some Levi's stuff, Foremost, a lot of jerky throughout it. And there were sweatshirts and other terrible stuff that I wish I hadn't sold cheap. But I kind of didn't have any idea until afterwards. I was up there and we had cleaned everything out. I found one more pair of jeans and was like, these are interesting. They say Levi on them, but the buttons are all donut shaped. And you probably know what that is. And the pockets were blank. So I hucked them out there for sale. And this guy
Sam Poole, scooped him up and he paid me a couple grand. And I was like, whoa, that's a lot of money for some torn jeans. And he was like, these are amazing. This is one of my favorite pairs ever. And his passion kind of started getting me just into it. And I was like, this is weird. Why is this guy so obsessed with dirty pants? And I kind of started to dive into the history and got obsessed with it. And known bad boy, Sam Poole, still has that pair of jeans. And he taunts me with them constantly because that was kind of my first big find. I'll get them back one
day,
Sam.
That's crazy.
One day.
One day, watch out. Oh. I was under the assumption that you've been in this longer than that. So you're really only 5 years deep sort of selling.
Yep. I quit my job as an engineer to do this full time. And kind of that focus in engineering and science, I've just lasered in on learning this denim thing. And now it's just all I think about, all I talk about. Pisses off all my friends and family. They just glaze over. I start talking about jeans and it's just
yeah, not good dinner conversation.
No,
at Thanksgiving. I heard a story from one of your friends that when you were a kid, you used to go into abandoned mines.
Mm-hmm.
You used to like tie off ropes and lower yourself into abandoned mines.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure your parents weren't too happy about.
Oh, they loved
that's probably
it.
One of the most dangerous things you could do as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, tell us about that. Like, that's pretty wild. Not a lot of kids can claim that they did that.
So I grew up in a mystery town, Montana, and there's a lot of mines out there. Britt would know exactly where, because I know he's already been through all those. But one of these mines, well, I'll back up a little bit. Yeah, so I went in those mines constantly, and I was finding just amazing old treasures and pieces of clothing, and even found two pairs of center patch, makes me sick, center patch Levi's. In decent condition, 1870s most likely. And I just thought, boy, these are weird. I'm wearing Levi's right now. I didn't know they were around that long. And I tossed them back down and left them. And
Jesus.
Fast forward to when I had that conversation with Sam, kind of about Levi's, and started paying attention. I was like, I know where some of these are, and they're still there. So I put my notice into my boss, and I was like, I'm leaving for the weekend. And he's like, no, I need you around. I was like, hopped in the truck and drove for 9 hours, went up there, picked up my brother, told him, I was like, hey, we're gonna get rich, we're gonna find these Levi's that are worth a fortune. It took us 2 days of hiking around to the mountains to find this old mine, because it'd been a decade, and we finally find it, and the hole is like this big, so it's all like caved in. So we like dig this thing out, crawl back in there, and I'm like, yeah, this is the one I remember, because these timbers and all that. And it was probably close to half a mile deep back in this mine where these jeans were laying when I had last seen them. We go in about 200 yards and it's just collapsed. The whole thing is just done. And I was like, all right, we're going to try and excavate this thing. And we dug a little bit, and just us disturbing the floor made rocks like this start coming off the ceiling behind us. And we're like, there's no way. There's no way we're going to get killed doing this. And this mine is so far back, there's no way you could ever get equipment there. It's like a foot trail to get there.
They're still in there.
They're still in there, boys.
Out there, buried in the dirt.
Yep, buried in the dirt.
Oh, that's so crazy, dude.
It's crazy.
I think we've all had, though, some like piece that's gotten away. It just happens to be that yours is like, yours is up
the
here.
Very top, yeah. Yeah, that was my shot. I was sure I was going to come back with them, but no.
Did anything come out of that trip? Did you find any other stuff in the mines?
Yeah, a stick of dynamite. We thought it was a candle. Picked it up, and I'm like, oh, let's just set that back down. And it was all crystallized and
looked like a candle. That's probably why the mine collapsed. Some
other idiot went in looking for those jeans.
Yeah, that's crazy. So Idaho, a good amount of dealers and pickers in Idaho, from what I know, from people I know. It seems like it's pretty good out there. Obviously, it's any rural place in America, you know, that has a history of farming, workwear, mining, all these things is going to produce product. So what's the competition like out there for what you do?
It's pretty.
You guys
stiff.
All work together, or is it tight? Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got a really good team. Huey Stitches, that's Houston on Instagram. There's Mallory Ridge, that's Andrew Simpson, and Retro on Main, that's Rose, and that's my team of four people, and we pick a lot together. Like, we don't ever like to go in somewhere just solo. And we found that kind of working together, we can really share our strengths. Like, Rose is really good at retail. She knows how to sell those lows and mids like crazy. And she knows more about the women's wear. Andrew is like a military nut expert. He just actually found this crazy jacket. He moved to a museum down in California.
Wow.
And Houston's our sweatshirt and t-shirt guy. And I'm Mr. Jeans. So we kind of all work together and complement each other's businesses. And we don't really flip off of each other. We trade and stuff, but I don't, like, Houston wouldn't buy $1,000 sweatshirt from me for $80, tell me it's nothing, and then flip it. He'll be like, bro, this is something special. So yeah, we kind of got that relationship, and it's cool to have people that got your back whenever you need to just jump in a truck and go dig through a mine or a barn somewhere.
Yeah, of course. And it's cool, like you said, that you guys complement each other and can work together in that way, because it's kind of rare. You know, yes. I've seen this more in the last 10 years than previous, where people are now working together. And, like, because you're right, you don't want to be out there doing some of this stuff alone.
No,
it
definitely
can be dangerous.
Not.
You don't know what situations you're going to get into. You need backup. You need extra hands just for the sheer workload of some of this stuff.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. And it is really dangerous. I mean, Andrew, I've watched him fall through the attic of a barn, and I think I've got a picture of it. I should probably put it on my Instagram, but he's like there hanging with his legs through the floor. And I've been trapped in mines before. I've had stuff collapse in behind me and had to dig my way back out, and I've been hit by rocks. And it's good to have somebody with you for sure.
So I got a question. This pertains back to you as a kid going into mines. So give us, like, your top five tips for going into abandoned mines.
Don't do it. Don't do it. It's dangerous and it's stupid. I mean, if you have kind of an idea of what you're looking for and, like, how to go into a mine and be safe, I mean, there's lots of poison gases that'll settle in these mines. There's CO, carbon monoxide gas, CO2, there's H2S gas. And, like, if you get into a high H2S concentration, the way I've heard it described is you can walk through it and it'll be like on the bottom couple feet of the floor, and stir it up, you'll take a breath and you'll feel dizzy. Your next breath, you'll be on the floor. Third breath, you're unconscious. Fourth breath, you're dead. And it'll get you that fast. So you want to take a detector with you, a multi-gas detector, if you're going to be doing that. I did a lot of mining kind of with my engineering degree, so I kind of have an idea of where it's getting dangerous, but it's unpredictable. I mean, one of these I was in, we were crawling through a hole maybe 2 feet wide, and I had my brother with me, and we go, and there's this opening, and we could actually see denim on the other side of where this floor had fallen out. We're like, boy, we got to try and find a way to get over there. And I look up, and right here, there's boulders the size of a car. They're being held up by willow branches that are just kind of woven into it. And they're like, they've like molded and turned to dust, but somehow they're still holding this boulder. And it's like, if I had like leaned against it, I'd probably still be up there. But top five things, top five tips is one, don't do it. It's dangerous. It's very dangerous. Two, if you're going to do it, make sure you got a hard hat, helmet, people to back you up. I think the next four tips are all safety. So
yeah, for sure.
I always take a string with me, and when I go into a complex, I'll take every single right. So if I'll take the first right and put a string in front of that left split. Take the next right, put a string in front of that next left split until I hit the end of all the rights, and then I come back and do rights again, putting a string in front of every direction except out, so I can find my way out of the thing. So another thing I would suggest is take really good lights, lots of batteries, food, water, because getting trapped in those things is really scary. And unless you're Brit Eaton, I wouldn't recommend rappelling down into those things because it's super dangerous. I've done that sort of thing and gotten stuck, had stuff get, the ropes get pinched and ropes get cut. Like it's really dangerous.
And I you already said this, but also probably take a gas detector because that sounds crazy.
I'd say that's number one, man.
And that happens just from like those gases come out of the ground and just pool up in those places.
Yeah. So they can, it comes from exhaust. And one, so my understanding is a lot of it will come from the timbers themselves and they're deteriorating and releasing gases that'll settle. So, and you, a lot of this stuff is odorless and you can't even tell. I mean, I know I hit one for sure and I didn't have a detector. But we had found this entrance where this one had caved in probably 100 years ago. It was crazy. And we start digging this thing out and we spend a couple days. And I mean, we're high school kids, so we had nothing else better to do. We dig this thing out. We finally unseal it. And it's like this blast of just stagnant air. So we crawled in anyways. Get down in there. And in the dust, like it was just so still and quiet in there in the dust, there was one set of cowboy boot tracks coming out back there in the dirt. And there was lots of cool stuff in there. But once we got further back in there, we started feeling like kind of gross, lightheaded, sick. And fortunately, it would have been low concentrations of poison gas or whatever it was. So we made it out, but probably shouldn't have.
So you said before you got stuck once, it collapsed behind you.
Mm-hmm.
Was this when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I was, I think, 17 or 18, and I had crawled through this small tunnel, maybe 3 feet across, trying to get back into this, see what was back there, and some stuff shifted, and some rocks just fell out, and it left a gap about like that, and you'd think you could just pull all those out of the way, but there's nowhere to put them, so it's like you gotta take a rock and walk it back to where there's more space and leave it and then come back and get another rock. And Mom, I hope you're not watching this.
Yeah, that's nuts, man. We used to, I grew up in Niagara on the Lake, Ontario, which is like near Buffalo, Niagara Falls, that area. And we had old forts where I grew up, right? It wasn't a mining town or anything, but there's these old eight forts from like the 1800s and they had tunnels and there was like tunnels from some of the houses to the fort. So like when the town was getting attacked, you could go into these tunnels and like evacuate the house to the fort, right? So, you know, we're all like in our teens partying and we would like be smoking weed at these forts or whatever we're doing. And we would like always dare each other, like go, because you could like crawl, they had it all gated off, but you could like crawl on the gates and like get into some of these tunnels and we'd like go back and see how far we could get. A bunch of them were like, I totally collapsed in too, because this is like hundreds of years old. But I just remember it being super freaky.
Oh, like, it's terrifying. And there's nothing like the darkness and silence and loneliness back when you're a quarter mile, half a mile under a mountain. One of my favorite stories, and this might be the one that one of my buddies was referring to, is we had crawled back into this mine maybe... Boy, it was a long, long ways. I mean, it may have been half a mile back. Just we are under this huge mountain. And we find this trap door in the floor of this kind of big, like almost like a cathedral room. But it, I mean, this thing was probably 100 feet across and it had all the tracks and everything with the carts were all met right there. And we go off this one tunnel and there's this trap door in the floor. And I mean, square nails, rope handle, just amazing old trap door. We lift this thing up and there's two ladders that just go down on either side, and we're shining our lights down there and we're like, man, we can't even see the bottom of this sucker. So we shut the lights off while we find this pipe that was like filled with concrete or whatever, and it was probably 40 pounds, 6 feet long. We take this thing, and it feels like when you've got the lights off, it's quieter, right? So we shut the lights off and we drop this dead center down the hole and it just goes, never hit. And we like, we listened for like 20 something seconds. We're like, what the? So we take a big old glow stick and snap this thing and drop it down the hall, and it just goes until the thing gets too dim to see anymore.
Wow.
Probably a big pile of Levi's at the bottom of that thing. But I had no desire to try roping into that. That, I don't know how deep that was, but it was, that really freaked us out, and we ended up getting out of there pretty quick because it was just so eerie.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like hundreds and hundreds of feet deep. These mines, like people, I think, because I used to think this too, like you'd think of a mine and you're thinking like someone digs into a mountainside, this straight tunnel, and that's it. Mm-hmm. But these mines, when you look at them like in a 3D rendering map, there's like shafts go down, mm-hmm. right? And then the tunnels are called something different, or?
Yeah, drifts.
Drifts.
Yeah.
So that it's like this spider web of like tunnels.
Oh, and yeah.
Shafts and drifts. And you're like, it goes for days. Like, we do have a mine near where I live. It's called Britannia, right? And it was I think copper and a few other minerals. Like, for a few hundred years, they ran this mine. Massive. And there's something like 5,000 kilometers of tunnels or
Dang.
Something within this mine.
Sounds good
know?
To me.
And.
Let's go.
The problem is, we're like in the Pacific Northwest. It's so rainy that like 90% of this mine is flooded out,
mm-hmm.
and it's just filled with water. Because I think they were pumped. They had to keep it pumped out for years and years and years when it was in operation.
Yeah, and that's one of the problems out here, kind of in where I live. And if you start to head east, is you get a lot more moisture, and a lot of those mines are full of water. But that's why a lot of people like Nevada, Montana, Wyoming, New Mexico, Arizona, is it's usually a little bit drier. But
once you have moisture in the system, the denim is dead anyway.
It's gone. I have found stuff and it'll almost look like a perfectly good pair of jeans, but it's literally just a ghost of what was sitting there at one point. Just dust. Just nothing left. But it's pretty cool though when you get in some of these and there's water that's just been sitting there forever and it's crystal clear. I was up in a mine in northern Montana once, and it had filled with water. So we were going down into this tunnel, and it had filled with water. So if you're thinking at an angle like this and the water sits like this, you couldn't barely tell that there was actually water there. It was so clear. So we're like shining our lights, and you can just barely see this reflection, but you can just see straight down into the tunnel. Like there's nothing, like there's no water there. It was that clear.
Yeah, no wind to disturb it, just perfectly flat.
And cold. Really cold.
Oh, that's wild.
Skinny.
So, you know, the whole finding genes in mines, to me, it's been very glorified, right? Obviously, mm-hmm. like it's the best story of how people find clothes. But in reality, and you can tell me if I'm off on this, but not a lot of stuff actually comes out of mines. It's super rare to find anything in a mine.
No,
most of the stuff comes from estates, people's houses, farms, mm-hmm. all the other ways that we find old clothes, old people that never let go of anything, people that through the Depression learned that you don't throw anything out and you keep it all.
And, mm-hmm.
and it's so different than people nowadays.
Yeah, I think Britt and Mike Harris kind of got all the mine genes already. There's only so many mines. And I mean, there are a lot that are way, way out there that I'm still finding and people haven't been in 100+ years, but I think a lot of that stuff has already been found. So to find anything that's, I'd say pre like 1910 is almost impossible unless it's underground. So structures just don't last that long. Water is going to find a way to get to that piece of denim or whatever that piece may be in 110 years, 120 years. So it's almost impossible to find anything that old on the surface. It has to be underground. Now, like I found a lot of like 20s stuff, buckle backs, like 20s, 30s, 40s. But to actually get something that's earlier, one pocket is just, it's underground. I don't know anybody who's actually really pulled a one pocket off the surface.
And by the surface, you mean like out of somebody's house or something like that?
Out of a barn, a house, a basement, anything like that. I mean, underground is where time just will stand still. As long as there's not rodents and water. I mean, I've been in mines and found like literally like remnants of food, you know, on plates and stuff like that. That's just, time just stops underground. But on the surface, there's always something that gets to it.
That's very interesting to me. I never thought about that fact. Like, I thought for sure somebody's attic, somebody's barn, mm-hmm. someone would have a one pocket late 1800s gene somewhere.
I've never got one that way. Only underground.
Wow.
So one of the weirdest ones, and I'm going to reach up and grab this real quick. This is really interesting. So this is a chin strap work shirt. Super, super old. Pretty good size. It's like a 44 or something. But it looks like it's in pretty good shape, right? You bet that came out of a mine or out of a good dry attic or basement. This shirt, actually, the guy got it from, found it buried in the sand in the desert on the surface. Like, part of it was sticking out of the sand, and it laid on the surface for over 100 years. So I think there's something to be said with how dry it is down there in Nevada, that some of this stuff will survive. So, I mean, it smells kind of like, it's got like a tar or pitch smell to it. So maybe it got soaked in something before it was left out there, but that's really probably the only instance I've ever heard of anything that old coming off the surface.
Yeah, that is, that's crazy. Just sitting there in the sand.
Mm-hmm. There were the Solomon Warner Levi's from 1890 something, 92 or 93, that came out of a trunk in somebody's attic, and they were dead stock one pockets. But that was like 10, 15 years ago, and they ended up selling somewhere in Malaysia. That's probably the only one I've ever heard of came out off of the surface.
Wow. I guess I don't pay that much attention to where these things are coming from. What's the oldest pair that you've ever had in your possession?
Oldest Levi's stuff. I mean, I've got some 1874 Levi's rivets that are pretty neat, but actual complete pairs, I can't really tell you. I've got some old stuff, though. Pretty old stuff.
And what about, like, you know, there's probably a lot more knowledge out there about dating Levi's mm-hmm. in particular than dating any other brand, because there's such a complete timeline, and they were the largest probably, right? So when you look to date like other brands, can we, you know, I'm not that into, I don't never see this shit. You know what I mean? I see like,
oh yeah,
me and Jesse were talking about it, and we probably had 5 bucklebacks, maybe 10 bucklebacks in the 20 mm-hmm. years we've been doing this, right? How's the knowledge about dating all the off brands and other things, and what are some of the things you can like look for to actually date something that's not a Levi's?
So I'll show you. Levi's was kind of the standard that everybody wanted to be, and that started in 73 when they put the rivet in, and there was a patent from 73 to 90, and no one else could run rivets at that time. So you know that if a jean is one pocket, doesn't have rivets, it's off-brand. They have different supports. I don't have an example up here, but so you know how old jeans, you know, you've got the rivets on them. Nobody else could have rivets from 73 to 90, 1873 to 1890, except Levi's. Everybody else wanted to be like Levi's, but they couldn't do the rivet because of the patent. So they would have other reinforcers. So instead of rivets, metal rivets, they would have leather patches sewn there, and at points of strain they would have maybe leather, or I've seen just a massive blob of like a dart, like where they just keep sewing and sewing and sewing and put like a what do they call it, a bar tack almost thing.
Yeah.
And as soon as that patent expired, everybody started slamming rivets on their jeans. So you know that would put a jean kind of in that time if it doesn't have rivets and you see those other features.
Yeah, and I was looking at old pictures of stuff that we had, and we had a pair of buckle backs with the Archuit, mm-hmm. the Levi's style Archuit, but they weren't Levi's. They were some off-brand that just copied the Archuit. You could tell because they had like a triple stitch seam line, and I was asking Sam about them, and he's like, yeah, these were off-brands. And people were literally copying everything, I guess, except for the, how could they copy the Archuit but without the rivet? Not copy the rivet.
So that would be stuff that's super, super old, and people were copying the Archuit or Archuit, however you want to say it, all the way up until about World War II. That's kind of when I saw it kind of stop. And I think Levi's just started suing the heck out of everybody because they got tired of their crap. Because everybody was knocking it off. Like, this is a 30s Foremost jean. See the arc you went there pretty well. Like, that's obviously Levi's inspired. Here's an older one, and I'll show you why it's older. You can kind of see the ghost of it there.
Yeah.
So another way that you can date these things, and this is what I have found to be pretty reliable, is take a look at where that buckle is placed on the jean. See how it's below the waistband?
Yep.
See how this one is on the waistband?
Yeah.
So belt loops on jeans mostly showed up in the early 20s. That's kind of when Levi started doing it and everybody else kind of followed suit. There were a few that started earlier. So on an early pair, you got belt loops. See the belt loops?
Yep.
They just slapped those babies on there while the buckle and the suspender buttons were already here. So now you have this big conflict here of a belt loop and buttons and a buckle, and it hurts your ass because there's all that stuff there. And that became a problem. So later on, they moved the buckle lower so it wasn't conflicting with the belt loops and having your belt run through there. And people got tired of these being under the belt and pushing into your back. So those went away on Levi's in 36, 37. And the buckle went away at the start of World War II. So if you don't have a buckle on your jean, it's likely World War II or newer. So here's a World War II 501. Notice the blank back pockets. This was right after the buckle went away, 1942. And I mean, I can kind of get into all the details. I think everybody kind of knows what a war jean is already. So,
yeah, we've talked about it, but I mean, the general gist is the war rations, right?
Where yep.
Everybody had to, like, the government mandated that all manufacturing be done with minimal supplies because all the supplies were going into the war effort.
Exactly. So this is a 501 jean, and during the war they called it an S501, and the S stood for what I believe was satisfactory. So satisfactory to meet war ration conditions. And they determined that this arcuate that you don't see on this jean because it's not there, the arcuate was not necessary to the construction of the jean. They also pulled the watch pocket rivets. So a World War II jean should not have those. And they had donut buttons. This pair has solid buttons. Here's the donut button variation. This saved a lot of metal when they were manufacturing these jeans. So if you have a war pair with all the war characteristics but solid buttons, you know it was an early war pair while they still had those solid buttons from earlier in the like they were just leftover buttons before they ran out of them and had to start using the classic donut buttons. And later on in the war, so you see the back pockets are blank. Levi's really needed that arcuate because it was part of their branding thing. And they felt it was necessary to have an arcuate on there. So they brought Artisan. I don't think you can see it, but this pair has a painted arcuate that you can see if you get your light right. And it sits right there. You can see it if the jean's wet. Very desirable feature, but it came off really, really quick once the jean was washed or worn too much.
It's so crazy to me that little bit of stitching for the back pockets made a difference, you know, like that little teeny bit of thread made a difference.
Oh yeah.
And they had to ration that out, you know, yeah, you can kind of say that about the buttons too, for sure. And then like, did Levi's actually get contracted? See, in my brain, I'm thinking about this and I'm like, I know why they had to ration. Everybody's rationing because they're probably ordering buttons from like a metal supplier who has to then create parts for guns or who knows what, right? But did Levi's themselves get contracted to actually make anything for the war effort? Do you know that?
So there's a lot of kind of conspiracy about that. They really didn't very much, but I have seen one or two pieces that were just crazy. I saw a dead stock World War II denim jumper, like, you know, the kind of shawl, the Navy shawl. I think it was a shawl. No, it I'm getting a couple things mixed up. It was a jumper, and it looked just like every single other jumper.
You're talking about the pullover with the big pockets here?
Yeah. Like, and it literally looked like every single other one of them. But inside it had a tag, Levi Strauss and Company. And it was really neat, and I really wanted it, but it ended up...
Yeah.
That's probably one of the only ones I've
seen. That thing has got to be worth a mint.
Oh, yeah. And then there was the Levi's... what did they call them? Spring bottom pants. Somebody found a pair that looked like they were U.S. Cavalry. They were pretty neat, and they looked like they were almost dead stock. 18.
And U.S. Cavalry would be like the Civil War or something?
Well, 1890s, 1900s. So not that old Cav, but they were Cav. They had the stripes on the sides, and those were pretty stinking neat. That was pretty recent. That was in the last year or two somebody found those. But as far as military collaboration, there really wasn't all that much.
Yeah, like I haven't heard of any. That's why I ask. And I think it's interesting. If they're rationing, they were probably putting efforts into something else at the time, of course, just like the whole country, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and since we're talking about war stuff, let me show you one. This is my most recent crazy find, and I found this in Mystery Town a couple days ago, actually. And this is the first time it's been seen, so here you go.
Nice.
This is
on the show.
A dead stock Carhartt chore coat with... It's all inverted, sorry. You see the S, and remember, S stands for satisfactory. So it is a war Carhartt chore coat, and it's got the label that says, the honor garment, Union made for the glory of the Union. And it's got the classic donut buttons with the laurel leaf for peace and the star for victory. But this one's really neat. It's also got these gigantic train buttons on it. I mean, these suckers are huge, too. They're like the size of a quarter. So it's kind of got a few conflicting things on it, but it's got the double stitch, which was a war thing as well. It's only got one cuff button as opposed to two or three, which a lot of these had. And it's got the four-button pattern down the front. Most chore codes are five. So that was a war thing as well. But yeah, this was just a random find in Mystery Town, and the guy had a pile of this stuff, and he just saved it from an old miner. He saved all the dead stock stuff, all the stuff that had a little wear or damage, he threw away just because.
Don't you hate when you hear that? Jeez.
All the time. I hear that 100 times for every time I find something. Oh, you shouldn't have been here last week. We took all of Grandpa's Levi's, and we had a bonfire, drank beer, and ate marshmallows.
Oh my God! So much. Somewhere it's happening right now.
And, Don't say that.
I want it. That jacket reminds me of something. You know, I one time picked a dead stock white black bear jacket, and I heard from one of your friends that that's your favorite brand.
I'm shaking.
Tell us about Black Bear. This was a long time ago, so I'll tell you about jacket quickly, but it had the flasher tag. It was a white chin strap Black Bear chore coat. I can't remember all the details. I probably can find a picture somewhere, but this was even before Instagram was like a thing. Mm-hmm. Beautiful jacket. And we've had certain Black Bear pieces over the years. I've definitely had a chin strap coverall. Now I know. I only learned this like last night. So tell us a little bit about Black Bear. What is it that makes it one of your favorite brands?
And so when I started hunting denim right after the big attic fiasco, I was like, okay, I got to find some more of this stuff. And it's not as easy as I thought it was going to be because I broke in easy, found an attic full of buckle backs and 40s denim. So I started looking hard and I spent a couple months and found jack, nothing. And this old lady reaches out to me from Mystery Town, and she's like, we were taking out this windowsill or taking out this window frame in our house, and this pair of jeans just fell out. And right away, I was like, okay, that's probably something old. And she sends me pictures. I love this Buckleback Black Bear jean.
Beautiful.
Very beautiful jean. And I was like, okay, I don't know anything about this stuff except people want it. And I rolled up and bought them from her. I think I paid $100 or something. And immediately tried to flip it. And only there was the one guy who was interested in it. He wanted to pay me like $150. I was like, it's pretty cool. I think I'll just hang on to it. And then I started researching it and just kind of built this just obsession with the stuff. And anytime I find a Black Bear piece, I jump up and down and celebrate. Here's a pair I just found recently. So we talked about World War II being double stitched and not having arcuates. So here's a World War II Black Bear jean. Donut buttons, and I think there's zinc. And I'm just obsessed with the stuff. It's really, really rare. It's based out of Seattle. They went out of business, I think, in the 50s, 40s or 50s. And a guy named Josh Serlin kind of bought the brand and brought it back to life. And now he's got a massive Instagram, massive following. And he's on the hunt for this stuff. And I'm on the hunt for this stuff. And every piece I find, I keep. And
they brought it back? The brand is now resurrected? Yeah.
And he's kind of making new pieces inspired by the older stuff. So it's really cool. And I'm obsessed with the stuff. And it's so rare. I mean, I'll fight 100 bucklebacks before fighting a really crazy Black Bear piece.
You know, the only reason we find it is because we get a lot of the rag that comes up to Vancouver would be from Washington, right? Yep. We're just over the border. You know, obviously Idaho is pretty close to Washington too. So you're going to be finding some there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's when you look at the geography of Washington, you have the mountains, like it's like the coast, like the Pacific Northwest coast. Then you have the mountain range. And then when you get over the mountains, you're basically into like dry deserty zone.
Yeah.
Of like the Washington, East Washington is like
it's
desert.
It's
right?
The desert. Yeah.
Yeah. We were in a town. I don't even know the name of the town. So it's Mystery Town. Mystery Town. Washington State. And we were like doing a dig, but this dig was all sports, right? Because this was like during the snapback days, probably 10 or 12 years ago.
Before
we got a line on this guy that had a sports store, went there, bought a bunch of old stuff. You know, the earliest stuff he had was probably like 70s t-shirt blanks, like old Russells and things like that. But in this town where he was, there was this old brick building. It was the classic like little main street of a town, old brick building, huge, like Black Bear workwear painting on the side of this brick building. We were like, holy shit. Like this was an old general store that probably was like one of their main retailers or something. Dang. And you know, obviously it was like a restaurant at that point or Jeez. Something like it had been changed, but the painting on the wall was still there. It was the coolest thing.
Dude. If you ever figure out where that is, send me a text. I want to go take pictures. I'm obsessed with that brand. And anytime a piece of it comes up, I flip out and do everything I can to land it. And I've been really blessed in the last month. So I had gone probably a year and a half without anything, not a thread. And then I was digging through this old camp trailer from the 80s, of all places, right? And finally got permission to get into this place. It was 3 years I tried to get in and finally got permission. And he's like, you can dig through the 80s camp trailer. I'm like, okay, I'd rather look in the barn, but okay, I'll look through this trailer. And I find this box of just denim. And I'm like, okay, this looks good. It's all 80s stuff, except for one hickory stripe piece. And I pull it out. I'm like, huh, okay, whatever. And then did I see what I thought I saw? And I pull it out and it's a hexagon pocket Black Bear piece. With the big label and the weird hexagon shaped pocket, and I about lost my mind.
That I now that you say the hexagon pocket, we've had the coveralls with that pocket.
Yeah, crazy.
And I do remember how unique that was. Obviously, when it comes to vintage, it comes to like what we do. That's the stuff people nerd out about because you're like, this is an interesting detail. It's different.
Mm-hmm.
It's something unique that maybe this one brand did, and all those pocket formations have a purpose, right? Because what is the chest pocket of a chore jacket or something for? It's for your watch, right?
Yep, your watch, your pen, or even your tools, whatever. And I'm not sure why that pocket is shaped like that, but the pocket guys go nuts over that one. I didn't even know about that pocket until that piece popped out of that box. And I was like, what is going on here? And I talked to Denim Seeker and he's like, bro, that's the Holy Grail. Congratulations. And I was like, yeah. So that one's in the safe right now.
All right, guys, another episode in the books. I had a lot of fun recording this one. I like talking to people who live different lives than me. They have different experiences. Jordan, great guy, great guest. Thank you for tuning in. If you guys are on the Patreon listening to the full episode right now, thank you so much for subbing. I appreciate it. I'll keep posting as much Patreon exclusive content as I can in there. But thank you guys for supporting the show. It means so much. It allows us to do this. It allows us to get fired up to create so much more for you. And if you listen to the free 45-minute version, get in there. Go sub to the Patreon or subscribe on the YouTube channel. And you yourself can get the full 2.5-hour episode. All right, that's it. If you want to shop fsandfrankvintage.com, please do so. Link down below. Also, make sure you comment where you listen to Vintage and Stuff podcast, wrong answers only, for a chance to win $100 credit, free shipping and everything to my website, fsandfrankvintage.com. All this beautiful product you see beside me, $100 of it could be yours. All right, thanks guys. See you on the next one. We are moving the episodes, dropping to Wednesdays now to make it easier. We're going to keep them firing, keep them coming. Hope you guys enjoyed. Peace.